Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On Monday, the media world was surprised, somewhat shocked, to learn that the Graham family's 80-year-long relationship with the Washington Post was coming to an end. It will now be owned by Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos, a man with a net worth of $25 billion. As the BBC reports, he will hardly miss the $250 million cash purchase price. Bezos joins a, quote, new breed of newspaper tycoons, rich white guys who have taken over struggling print publications. The Washington Post experienced a 44% dip in operating revenue over a six-year period, according to reporter Paul Farhi. The purchase raises so many questions about the future of the Washington Post. When the announcement was made, Jeff Bezos said, quote, "The values of the Post do not need changing. The paper's duty will remain to its readers and not to the private interest of its owners. We will continue to follow the truth wherever it leads and will work hard not to make mistakes," end quote. But what does following the truth mean exactly, especially when it comes to covering things like Amazon's business practices, working conditions in its warehouses, the death of independent bookstores, and so many other relevant issues? Joining us to talk about media coverage and to answer these questions is Jay Green. He is a business reporter with the Seattle Times, and a few years ago, Jay and his colleagues wrote a very in-depth story about Amazon business practices and philanthropy. Hi, Jay. Welcome to the show.
How you doing?
Great. Thanks for joining us. And we're also joined by John Nichols, Washington correspondent for The Nation magazine. Hi, John. Welcome back.
It's great to be with you.
Great to have you. And U.S. and Russian officials are meeting today, just days after President Obama canceled a summit in Moscow with President Vladimir Putin. The expected announcement came after Putin gave asylum to Edward Snowden, the former NSA contractor who gave Guardian columnist Glenn Greenwald between 15 and 20,000 classified documents. On Tuesday, Glenn Greenwald told congressional hearings in Brazil, they're actually investigating U.S. internet surveillance in Brazil, that the articles that have published are just a small part of what's to come. More than 150 civil society organizations from around the globe are asking President Obama to end the prosecution of Edward Snowden. And joining us to talk about this is Fred Weir, Moscow correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, who has been closely following this. His latest pieces, Russia seeking Snowden's help on data security. After airport exit, what will Edward Snowden do in Russia? Hi, Fred. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks very much.
Great to have you. So as we always do on Friday, we start off on a positive note and give kudos to a reporter who did a good job this week. So, John, let's start off with you. What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Yes, I would be glad to. It's and this is a rare one because usually we go for some sort of big, long magazine piece or a newspaper piece or something like this. But today I want to celebrate a piece by Eyewitness News 4, KOB in Albuquerque, New Mexico, a guy named, and I hope I pronounce his name right, Steve Mikowski. And what he did last weekend was pretty fascinating. He exposed and got to the heart of the real power agenda setting in America. There's a huge resort outside of Albuquerque, and it was rented by someone, the entire resort. And then security checks were put up a mile away from the resort. And it was unclear who was there. Nobody was answering questions about it. So he and his crew, or this KOB crew, went out to as close as they could, spent a lot of time around, checked on airports in the vicinity on planes that had flown in, and eventually were able to expose or write that the Koch brothers had rented the resort and then flown in top members of Congress like Paul Ryan, the Budget Committee chair, and Eric Cantor, the number two Republican in Congress, as well as governors and others from around the country, for a private summer meeting. And it really was, I mean, other people had intimations of this, but KOB, this TV station down in New Mexico, really detailed things and got a good story.
So what were they doing there exactly?
Plotting the future of the United States. No, I mean, I'm not kidding.
Yeah,
I mean,
no,
they're talking. policy. They're talking how they want to approach big issues. Mm. What has come out slowly with a lot of other good reporting by other folks is that, Paul Ryan's folks have ultimately been honest. They've confirmed when asked that they were that the congressman was there. Nobody wants to say exactly what went on, but people who were around and apparently know what's going on. So there's a lot of discussions about the 2014 elections,
right?
About approaches to politics and media and kind of all the things we'll discuss in the rest of this show. But what's important is, I think we often underestimate the value of sort of just shoe leather reporting.
Mm.
And that's what this station did.
Well, thank you for that. We'll put a link right after the show. And since you brought that up, John, I just wanted to give kudos to the Center for Media and Democracy and PR Watch, because ALEC is turning 40, the American Legislative Exchange Council, and they're having a 40th gathering in Chicago. Actually, 16 people were arrested yesterday. There's some video of police going after protesters with billy clubs. And the Center for Media and Democracy has a new report out identifying 466 ALEC bills in 2013 that reflect what they call the corporate agenda. So, and this isn't getting much attention at all in the media.
I will tell you, Rose, we've got a lead story on the Nation.
Oh, good. Well, I should say in the national media, but in the independent media, I hope it does get attention.
Agree.
Yeah. Thank you, John. Jay, what about you? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
You know, one of the things actually that intrigued me is, it's funny, it's just an old Q&A, but sometimes Q&As really work. And this is Brad Stone in Business Week did a really interesting Q&A with Bill Gates. And, you know, one of the things with Gates is he's a smart guy, but he can often be prickly, and sometimes he gets cornered in Q&As and doesn't do a particularly good job with them. This one, he was really quite expansive, and he talked about not just, you know, what he's doing with his foundation, but he took some shots at Google and sort of its efforts in the third world by bringing, you know, internet access. And, you know, Gates said, well, that isn't going to do a whole lot to, you know, resolve issues like malaria. But it was just a really interesting interview that he, you know, I thought Brad Stone did a great job asking these fairly open-ended questions and getting Gates to be expansive and talk about not just what he's doing, but some of his pet peeves with regard to philanthropy as well.
Did he ask at all about the privatization of education?
You know, he talked a bit about education. It was more about his agenda in the third world. But the focus on education was more about the influence that the Gates Foundation is beginning to wield, or not beginning, but is wielding, with regard to where money goes in education. But he didn't speak about charter schools or any of those issues in particular.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because we're actually planning to do a show in the near future about the Gates Foundation. So thank you so much for that, and we'll link to that right after the show. What about you, Fred? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, since I've been covering Edward Snowden so closely, because he is our guest here in Russia, I've been doing a lot of reading and watching about all of the ramifications of his revelations. And one of the things I would have suspected, because I'm a bit of a cynic, is that the NSA, which got this vast license to do global surveillance of the Internet and telecommunications on the strength of the need to fight terrorism, would experience some mission creep. You would suspect that. And this week we saw very good reporting from the States that shows, indeed, the NSA has set up some sort of a clearinghouse where information that it gathers from all of its various sources gets turned around and sent to other law enforcement agencies, who are then told, you take this information and you recreate the trail so you don't let on where you got it from. Now, it seems to me almost impossible to overstate the importance of this, because it means that it's not about fighting terrorism at all. Or originally it is, but it is now like an octopus spreading all over, so that eventually this mass surveillance will become the new normal. Now, I happen to have this from the Rachel Maddow show, because I download the podcasts and watch them here in Moscow, and I get a lot of my U.S. news from that. But I'm sure that there are many sources for this story, and I just think it is the most important story of the week.
Fred, if you wouldn't mind speaking up a little bit, we're having some problems with your phone line. Can you elaborate on that a little bit? I'm trying to understand, in terms of the NSA clearinghouse, can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, well, they collect vast amounts of information. This is already pretty well established from what has been published so far.
Right.
And the impression we all get is that the NSA is devoted mainly to national security and primarily the fight against terrorism, the threat of terrorism to American citizens, and I doubt that there are very many American citizens who disagree with that on principle. But do you disagree with the idea that that information gathered in that way might be handed to the IRS or to the DEA or to the FBI? Because apparently that's what's happening. Any kind of criminal case now, the law enforcement agencies, and there are over a dozen of them, can appeal to this NSA clearinghouse to get the information that they've gathered through this blanket surveillance, and it is then, according to the reports I've seen, then given to them in a package, but it's a confidential package. They aren't ever to cite it or say where they got it. They're told, you should recreate this trail of information separately so that whatever you take to court will be generated by you, whichever law enforcement agency it is. Now, that has enormous ramifications, and not least of all for defendants who have no idea, who will go to court never being told who fingered them in the first place. Where did the evidence that triggered this investigation against me come from? You see, I'm not an American myself. I'm a Canadian. But I find this appalling.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. We should give kudos to Reuters for breaking that story. And in the piece about this secret U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration program, and Nancy Gertner, a Harvard Law School professor who served as a judge from 94 to 2011, said, quote, I have never heard of anything like this at all. She said this is actually more troubling than the recent disclosures that the NSA has been collecting domestic phone records. And we're actually going to do a show on Monday to try to put all of this in context. John, what are your thoughts about that? Because so much information is coming out at one time, and The Guardian's Glenn Greenwald says, you haven't seen anything yet. I mean, we've got so many more documents that we have to read over and then write about. Do you feel like the media are putting this in context so we can understand what this means exactly?
No. I mean, I would assume that your question is rooted in an understanding and a respect that the media has struggled with this. That some of the media, I think, has tried to bring perspective to it. And frankly, you know, we live in a new age, right? We don't have to wait for the New York Times to hit our doorstep in the morning. The Guardian, which Americans have immense access to, and frankly, which is now seeking to be an American news outlet in the sense that it's, if you go to its cover page, it focuses on U.S. news and U.S. development, has, I think, done a lot of work to try and give perspective. I think some other publications have worked on this. I do think the Times has made some effort in this regard. I think, by and large, television has struggled with it, although I would suggest that Chris Hayes on MSNBC has done some pretty good work. I think, ultimately, if you go to Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman, you tend to get the broad picture and a real sense of things over time. But with those exceptions and a few others, I would suggest to you that it's been a very, very disappointing period. And I don't think we can entirely blame the media. I think we have to look at what I would suggest is a combination of a crisis in media, dumbing down of media. We have far fewer serious and experienced national security correspondents than we used to. But also, I think a huge collapse of the role of Congress in issues like this. The fact of the matter is that 40 years ago, when we had a lot of revelations about domestic spying and security issues, and
really a lot coming out, and I don't think people, younger folks may not even have a sense of how much was coming at folks in 1972 and 1973. Not just Watergate, but the Pinochet coup in Chile, revelations about things that had happened in Vietnam. We weren't far off the Pentagon Papers. Daniel Ellsberg was still being prosecuted. There was all this stuff in play. And what happened? The United States Senate, under Frank Church, the United States House of Representatives, under Otis Pike and others, held massive and intensive hearings. They took this stuff very, very seriously, and it was in that process that we began to get a sense of it all and some perspective. We also got laws and requirements and a measure of response. At this point, I would suggest to you that the response of our U.S. Congress has been absolutely absurd in its level of disengagement. Few people have spoken up, and I appreciate that and respect conservatives and liberals who've tried to raise some of these issues. But for the most part, the congressional response has been so absurdly disengaged that it has created a situation where I think an awful lot of the media, which tends to follow what happens in official Washington, for better or worse, doesn't know where to go.
That's John Nichols, Washington correspondent with The Nation magazine. Fred Weir is Moscow correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. And Jay Green is a business reporter with the Seattle Times. On today's Your Call, it's our media roundtable, and we're discussing coverage of, well, we're going to talk about the Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos buying the Washington Post for $250 million. Now we're talking about the NSA and, you know, what outlets are really putting this in context. And we'd love to hear from you on this. Have you seen a good article that just looks at what's been revealed over the last month and really puts it in perspective? What does this mean exactly? This is the question we're going to be asking on Monday. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website. And if anything else struck you in the media this week, we'd love to hear from you, especially if you saw good reporting. Jay, you're a business reporter with the Seattle Times, and when an explosive story like this hits, where it's getting so much national coverage, what role does a paper like the Seattle Times play?
Well, I mean, you're talking about the NSA story, you're talking about
NSA.
The Bezos story.
Yeah, NSA.
Well, you know, honestly, the staff here is smaller than it once was, and so I think for the most part, we are relying on coverage of others. Now, there are columnists who will opine on it, and if there are local angles to it, I'm sure we will be covering that. But honestly, the NSA coverage is largely coming from our partners, you know, the people who the Times gets coverage from, at the New York Times and the Washington Post and other wire services that we use.
What about the question of the role the private sector plays in surveillance?
In terms of the Seattle Times' coverage or just broadly?
Well, Jeff, I was looking this up. Jeff Bezos has connections to, doesn't he have a contract with the CIA?
So Amazon Web Services, I believe, has a contract with them to provide their infrastructure software.
Right. So how should that be covered when you're talking about surveillance and the NSA?
It's a good question. I mean, you know, there are definitely companies, and it isn't just, obviously, you know, Amazon. Microsoft has contracts providing, you know, Outlook and Exchange and things like that with the government as well.
Right.
And you know, geez, there are international ones too. I mean, there's a company out of China called Huawei, which has gotten a ton of attention, you know, in Congress because it provides routers and a lot of back-end technology that winds up getting pretty complex, but it, you know, provides a lot of these sorts of technologies that Congress has discouraged American companies from buying because it's concerned about those issues. So I think those come up, but it's one of those interesting ones where until you get a guy like Snowden who can provide this information, it all becomes speculation and it becomes conspiracy theory, and it requires that smoking gun that you get from somebody like Snowden that, you know, where you can actually draw those lines. But no, as far as I know, to date, nobody's drawn any kind of conspiracy lines from Amazon Web Services or Microsoft or for that matter, Huawei to conspiracy, you know, to snooping.
Right, because there's a lot of questions about the role that Silicon Valley plays with the government. I mean, what happens when, a subpoena is issued, for example? Or we just got word this morning that this company that Edward Snowden used to send emails shut down, and it's called Lavabit. And the owner of Lavabit wrote a message online saying, quote, "I have been forced to make a difficult decision to become complicit in crimes against the American people or walk away from nearly 10 years of hard work by shutting down Lavabit." He said he was barred from discussing the events over the past 6 weeks that led to his decision. "Without congressional action," he said, "or a strong judicial precedent, I would strongly recommend anyone trusting their private data to a company with physical ties to the United States." That's a strong statement, John Nichols.
It sure is, and it's one that ought to be explored by our media. And I think our friend from the Seattle Times reflects well on one of the complex realities of what's involved with newspapers, and that is that our regional dailies, which once kind of rose to the level of trying to compete on these national stories, are in a tougher place. They've faced a lot of cuts, and those cuts, whether we like to admit it or not, have made it much harder for a lot of our good quality dailies across the U.S. To dig into all of the issues with national security. But this is one that I think has real potential in some areas of the country where we have a lot of tech headquarters, places like Seattle, places like the Silicon Valley, San Francisco area. And frankly, a number of other places around the country. This is a good issue to dig into. And I don't think it has been worked over nearly enough. The fact of the matter is, and Bob McChesney and I write about this in our new book on media and politics, one of the things that happens when we have a discussion like this is we focus so intensely on what the government does, on what Washington does, and we lose sight of the role of our tech companies in issues like data mining. The fact of the matter is that, yes, our government does data mining, but it's certainly not alone in doing this. The private sector does an immense amount of data mining, and our political class does an immense amount of data mining. We've got a chapter in our book on the extent to which the political parties dig through our information, the information we give them mainly via the Internet, for two purposes. One, to raise a lot of money from us, and two, to influence how we vote. And these are issues that particularly media that covers tech communities, that covers tech issues, and that's not just newspapers, it's also magazines, really ought to be digging into more. I cannot emphasize how little the American people know about the extent to which their information is used not merely to investigate them in a governmental setting, but to influence and control them in the private sector. And these are great issues that journalists should be digging into a lot more.
Yeah, and that's the issue that we're going to be covering extensively on Monday's show. That is John Nichols, Washington correspondent for The Nation. Jay Green is business reporter with the Seattle Times. When we come back after a break, Fred Weir, I'll ask Fred to talk about how this is playing out in a security state like Russia, where Edward Snowden has just been granted asylum. Fred is Moscow correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. And we'd love to hear from you. So much information is coming out about government surveillance. And where are you finding a good story that puts all of this into context and kind of lists everything and then lets you know how this actually affects citizens? You're listening to Your Call. It's our Friday Media Roundtable. We'll be back after this.
All of the stories you hear recommended on the Friday Media Roundtable are posted at yourcallradio.org. And we invite you to highlight the reporting that you thought was valuable this week by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Or you can send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we are going to have a conversation about the scope of government surveillance in the U.S. We'll talk about the NSA and other agencies that gather and store troves of information on Americans. How do they do it? What do they do with it? How should we make sense of all of these revelations? And what actions can people take that might lead to any kind of change? And then we're also putting shows together about the anniversary of the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. We had a conversation with Gary Young yesterday about his book about the I Have a Dream speech. Next week, we'll have a conversation about what that jobs and freedom really meant back then, 50 years ago, and what they mean now. We're also putting shows together about U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East and John Kerry's recent visit to broker another round of talks with Israel and Palestine. Why are they investing so much time and effort in this right now? What are their main goals? What explains this? And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, it's our media roundtable, the day we discuss coverage of the week's news. And we're talking about coverage of all of the NSA revelations, Edward Snowden, U.S.-Russia relations. And then in just a bit, we'll talk about Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos buying The Washington Post for $250 million. We're joined today by Jay Green, business reporter with The Seattle Times, John Nichols, Washington correspondent with The Nation, Fred Weir is Moscow correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. So, Fred, how is this all being covered in a security state like Russia? Russian law passed in 1995 allows the Federal Security Service to monitor telephone and internet communications.
Well, yes, Russia is a security state, and unfortunately, we don't know a fraction about what Russian security services do compared to what we know now about the NSA. And it's partly because of this that Russian leaders, particularly Vladimir Putin, have treated Snowden's unexpected appearance on Russian soil with such ambivalence. On the one hand, it represents a huge, shall we say, propaganda victory for Russia. Mm-hmm. It's almost a Cold War turning of tables. Like, now it's Russia that American dissidents flee to find asylum. On the other hand, Snowden is not a classical defector. He didn't come with a computer full of secrets to give to Putin and to pledge allegiance to Russia in the old-fashioned way. He is this crusader for global transparency, which Putin probably despises every bit as much as Obama does. However, Russia was put in a position where they couldn't back down, and Snowden was simply unable to go anywhere else. All his routes to any place were effectively blocked by American pressure, and we saw that most vividly in the downing of the Bolivian president's plane over Europe. If you can take down the plane of a sovereign president, any commercial airliner or chartered plane could obviously be grounded too. So Snowden was stuck in Russia, and Russia, I do not know. I think it may be some time before we know all the deliberations and considerations that went into it, but Russia has decided to give him a year's temporary political asylum here.
How is the public responding to this, Fred? You've got Edward Snowden given political asylum, and two of the Pussy Riot members are still in jail.
Yeah, of course, there are immense contradictions here, and much is made of that. But I don't think it's fair to blame Snowden for it. He hasn't said anything. He's not a classical defector. He didn't come over here and throw his allegiance behind Putin or Russia. He's expressed the bare minimum of gratitude that you would pretty much have to expect for people who are taking you in and giving you refuge. But he hasn't made any statements that glorify Russia or vindicate its policies or anything like that. So I don't think it's fair to tar him with this brush. He may, however, get drawn into the geopolitical struggle that Russia has with the United States. And frankly, this is a critical issue. Russia and China and a few other countries have a pre-existing campaign. They've been pursuing this since long before Snowden showed up. And their idea is that governance of the Internet should be taken away from ICANN, the American-based corporation that pretty much gives out Internet addresses and so on, that more or less controls the Internet. The Russians and Chinese and several other countries think that that should be put under a UN body and perhaps made more diverse. In Russia, they are talking about having control over their own national Internet, especially the allocation of domain names and so on, and also force, and this is in the wake of Snowden's disclosures, they want to force big Internet companies like Google and Yahoo and Microsoft and Apple and Twitter to keep servers in Russia, which will contain all the data of Russian users. Because all of these companies do have big slices of the Russian market, you know. And so it's a legitimate point. Russian parliamentarians will be holding hearings on this, in fact, and they will invite Snowden to testify about it. But on that level, it's perfectly legitimate. I think many countries will be pursuing this. Like, what are the implications for our citizens of Snowden's revelations? Because so far, most of the discussion centers around, because it's U.S.-centric, centers around what are the implications for American citizens.
Right, exactly. Well, and it was interesting, Fred, to read your piece about Russia's upper house of parliament asking Snowden to advise the country on improving Internet privacy and security.
Yes. And as I say, that's probably quite a legitimate thing. If any country, and probably many countries, will be doing that. On the other hand, it does play into the geopolitical agenda of Russia, which is to change the structure of the Internet and perhaps gain more control nationally over the data of users of Russian citizens. And that, of course, invites deep skepticism from critics, because if you do that in a security state such as Russia, you're effectively, well, you may be strengthening national independence, you're effectively handing way more control over to your own local security services. So it's a double-barreled thing.
Yeah, well, we're going to have to do a show on this, Fred, because there's just so many angles here. Journalists being cracked down on, and then the Olympic Committee is waiting for the Russian government to clarify the anti-gay law signed by Vladimir Putin in June, which bans, quote, propaganda of non-traditional sexual relations. So we're going to have to really dive into these issues and talk about whether or not, because of the asylum, these other issues are getting attention. So thank you so much for joining us, Fred.
My pleasure.
That is Fred Weir. He is Moscow correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, and he's been, as you can imagine, writing extensively about Edward Snowden and these security issues, and you can find his reporting at yourcallradio.org. And today it's our media roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar, and Jay Green, business reporter with the Seattle Times, and John Nichols, Washington correspondent with The Nation, will be with us for the rest of the show, and we're going to talk about media coverage of Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos spending $250 million for the Washington Post. This got so much attention this week because so many people were taken aback and surprised by it. And what really struck you about the coverage? What are your thoughts on someone like a Jeff Bezos buying a massive paper like the Washington Post? And what does this say about journalism? 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. And if there was a story you saw this week that you'd like to talk about, we'd love to hear from you. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website. So I listened to so much coverage, Jay, and read a lot of articles, but I still am unclear about why Jeff Bezos would want to buy the Washington Post. What are your thoughts on that?
I was going to say, you and me both. he was entirely opaque about that. There are plenty of people who have speculated about it. The way it came down is that Don Graham, whose family has owned the Post since the 1930s, I believe, had a conversation with Bezos several months back and said that the family was looking for a buyer and would Bezos be interested. And at the time, Bezos said no, and he then rethought it. And a few months ago, got back to Don Graham and said, if it's still on the table, let's talk. But he was not clear at all in his note to the staff of the Post why he was going to buy the paper, and he has not been particularly clear since. So it really is an interesting purchase, and it's interesting given his history as well. I mean, he's a guy who has, made his billions disrupting old industries with new technologies. And so it's even more confounding in some sense that he's buying what is essentially an old business and an old industry and, suggesting he's going to revamp it, because that hasn't been his modus operandi in the past.
Has he done any interviews this week? And what is it like to try to interview someone like Jeff Bezos since you're in Seattle?
Well, so two things. Has he done any interviews? The only one I have seen is with Paul Fahey of the Washington Post, and it seemed very brief, and there wasn't a lot in there that I drew from that. I will say, in terms of my meeting Bezos, I met him 15 years ago and had a conversation with him. I've bounced around a bit and have not covered Amazon until recently, so I haven't had the opportunity to interview him. Having read other interviews of him, in the last few years, he is a guy who I think can be charming and affable. He's direct. He's intense. He sort of has a lot of the characteristics that you hear of so many other tech moguls.
John Nichols, what are your thoughts on that? It's interesting. He gave an interview to a Washington Post reporter, and Jeff Bezos is now, he'll be his boss soon.
Well, let's start with this. I thought the Onion newspaper, the humor newspaper, summed up the purchase best. With the headline, "America Stunned as Man Buys Newspaper." because we know the circumstance of daily newspapers in this country. There aren't a lot of people running to purchase them on the street, let alone purchase the whole operation. It happens that there are two kinds of purchases of newspapers at this point in America, big daily newspapers. One is a rich guy, right? And rich guys have been buying newspapers pretty much since this country was started. It is a long tradition, and we tend, when a rich guy buys a newspaper, to focus on his, or sometimes, and there are rich women occasionally that do so and have done very well, we focus on their personality. We say, what kind of person is that? Would we like having a drink with that guy? Is he a businessman? Well, yeah, he's a businessman. He made a lot of money. Is he a good businessman? Is he a bad guy? Does he like public education? Does he like private education? We go all absurd. But what we don't do is focus our attention on who usually buys newspapers. And it isn't usually a rich guy. It's usually a hedge fund or a consortium of, money folks who are buying the paper with the sole purpose of gutting it out, literally eating it alive for... Even, they're circulation lists. There are people who are buying newspapers for the circulation lists or for the downtown buildings,
Can you give us an example of this, John?
Yeah, the guy who owned the Tribune Company. I mean, there's a lot of evidence that the Tribune Company was purchased several years back with the purpose of getting its real estate rather than actually, running a good newspaper. And so what I want to emphasize to you is that we have a crisis in media ownership in the United States today. And that crisis has created a circumstance where our biggest newspapers, and newspapers that we still respect and have a lot of regard for, are kind of always on the block. They're almost always available. The immediate response to the Washington Post sale was questions of, is the New York Times for sale? New York Times said, oh, no, it's not for sale. Well, you know, let's see what happens if the right person walks up with the right pile of money. And here's where it gets, where it ought to be concerning to us. We're left in a circumstance as a country with a choice between two kinds of purchasers. One, usually a rich guy who, you know, we sort of were thrown back to the you know, regal ages of the past. He might be a good king, he might be a bad king, but he's still going to be a king. Or an investment group or a bad investor that really is not even interested in journalism at all. On balance, in a circumstance like that, a lot of people, and I've talked to Post reporters, you know, they're going to say, well, you know, on balance, we'd rather have a rich person who isn't here simply to gut the operation and will take the slings and arrows, the challenges of that person's influences or ideas or personality or whatever. And I understand that response. But what I would suggest to you is this is a highly problematic circumstance for a republic in which so much of our governance relies on an informed populace. And it is still big city newspapers and national papers that maintain the newsrooms that are, by and large, best positioned to dig out that information.
You know, I think it's what you're saying is fascinating because I think it's really interesting, and I think you're entirely right, but it is also the same as it ever was, right? I mean, if we, and you said this too, but if you go back in time, of course, it's a bunch of rich white guys who own newspapers, you know, from time immemorial, right? The Pulitzers are named after Joseph Pulitzer, who owned a few newspapers, right? There's a castle just down the road from you there in the Bay Area that was built by William Randolph Hearst off the riches that he made owning newspapers. So there have been a bunch of rich white guys throughout history who have owned newspapers, and I think, as you say, the challenge isn't so much that it is an individual, but who that individual is and what he or she wants to do with that paper. But I think John's entirely right. If it's the choice between that and a hedge fund that's interested in, you know, selling off the buildings and trying to figure out a way to get out of pension liabilities, it's probably a better thing. And then you just have to wrestle with the fact of what does this individual want to do with the newspaper and why does he or she want to buy it.
Right. And then also the next logical question is how will the Washington Post cover a lot of these issues? I heard this asked a few times, but reporters said, well, how will they cover the future of digital technology? But, you know, I wonder how will they cover Amazon's business practices, the warehouse workers and what they have to deal with. Jay, your colleagues had a great report last year just about how difficult it is to work in an Amazon warehouse. The hours are really long. At one point, it was so hot that they had to have a medical staff outside because people were fainting. I mean, these are the issues that really affect real people, and things do not change unless those are exposed. So how do you think the Washington Post will deal with these issues?
So one of my favorite stories that came out of, on the Post, it was on, I think it was Wednesday, whatever, the 7th. Yeah, on Wednesday, I'm just looking at it now, it came off of the Wonk blog, and it was a little piece about Amazon starting something called Amazon Art, where they're going to be selling fine art. And again, this is in the Washington Post, and the headline was, Amazon nearly destroyed local bookstores. It may do the same with online art sites. And I love the headline because it's very clearly, you know, the writers for this blog, and I'm sure it was a blog and not in the paper, but nevertheless, they were testing those waters. It's going to happen that, you know, it wouldn't surprise me at all if the folks at the Post did, you know, push some of these buttons to see how far they're allowed to go. I will tell you that Jeff Bezos is a smart businessman, and he is not going to do something that obviously undermines the $250 million he spent buying this asset. He will get skewered. He will get pilloried if he steps in and forces coverage that seems inappropriate or unethical, or somehow forces folks to support his business in the news pages. What I think will be more interesting is to watch the editorial pages. And there, it seems possible that the editorial coverage could support issues that matter to its new owner. And so you could think about things like internet taxation. Those things could come up and maybe, you know, issues with regard to antitrust law. But I would be stunned.
And, you know, maybe I will be stunned, but I would be stunned if the news pages, particularly of a sort of crown jewel newspaper that attracts so many talented, you know, reporters and editors, I'd be stunned if they all of a sudden are told they're not allowed to write about, you know, or the topics that involve Amazon, or at the very least told they have to write in a specific manner about those topics.
And that's Jay Green, business reporter with the Seattle Times, John Nichols, Washington correspondent with The Nation. We've got just about 6 minutes left. If you'd like to weigh in on this, there are a lot of big questions here, what this means for the future of journalism. In fact, in one of John's latest pieces, he says, the big question we need to ask is, will we have a sufficient journalism and a sufficiently independent journalism to sustain democracy? And if you'd like to just weigh in before we end today, it's 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Let's hear from Roger in San Francisco. Hi, Roger.
Hi, and thank you for this opportunity. There is no better way to control a population than control what they see, hear, and read. You know, sometimes it has tragic consequences. First, in the Spanish-American War, that was an internal explosion in that battleship. Iraq, where so many articles were written against, I'm talking about the second Iraq War, so many articles were written against that war, but they were shelved. And only articles that supported the government's position were getting through. You can go back to the Vietnam War. So much control because newspapers, television, radio was influenced by their owners. You know, how they influence it is simply hiring people that share their personal philosophy. And I don't know anything about this Jeff Bezos. Maybe he's a good guy and he's going to let that newspaper, that grand newspaper, have freedom. We wouldn't have had Watergate if it wasn't for the Washington Post. You know, it's important to have a free press. And, Rose, I think sometimes the last bastion of free information will be talk radio itself.
Well, let's hope that doesn't happen, but thank you for calling, Roger. John, what are your thoughts?
Well, my sense on this is that Roger gets to a lot of the heart and soul issues, but I really want to emphasize in the short amount of time that we have left how important it is to worry less about Jeff Bezos than about the great pattern of newspaper and media ownership in the United States. By and large, our media is owned by people who argue for a center-right stance on most issues. And the interesting thing is, we talk about, will Jeff Bezos change the editorial stance of the Washington Post? Well, the fact of the matter is, the Washington Post tends to agree with him on all sorts of issues already. And what we really lack in our country is a commitment to assure that there is sufficient funding of journalism so that we have a diversity of voices coming from a lot of different perspectives. Other countries do that. The Scandinavian countries, which rank the highest on the Economist magazine's measures of democratic openness, of freedom of the press, of freedom in general, those countries provide tremendous levels of support for independent, diverse journalism through all sorts of different mediums. Same is true with BBC in Britain, a lot of other countries. In our country, we are starving journalism. We are providing insufficient resources to it, and we are leaving it to the chance of who buys a publication. That is not a good model for sustaining democracy.
Well, we've got time for one more caller on this. Let's hear from Chris in San Francisco. Hi, Chris.
Hi. I just wanted to say I'm actually encouraged that Bezos didn't give a lot of interviews. I mean, my impression of the Grahams was that they understood that they're a behind-the-scenes role and that their job is to make it possible for the reporters to do their job. And the fact that Bezos is sort of taking a quiet approach at the beginning here seems to be more in the Graham tradition than, say, in the Murdoch tradition. And I think that's a good thing.
All right, thank you. Jay, what are your thoughts? Is it good that Jeff Bezos is not giving interviews?
Listen, I make my living getting those kind of interviews, but, you know, I'd say no. But, I mean, beyond that, the one thing I'd say is that it isn't about grandstanding or saying, you know, pounding your chest and saying, look what I bought. It's honestly about saying, you know, how he expects to run that organization going forward. Because, as I say, it's opaque. It's unclear really what he intends to do. He talked some in a note to the staff about experimentation. Well, what does that mean? And so, you know, I would have loved to have seen more on that, and I'm sure he will over the course of time, but it would have been a good thing, and I think it would have allayed a lot of the concerns you hear about in the Post newsroom if we had heard a bit more about that.
And Jay, final thoughts. How will this change the way the Seattle Times covers Amazon and Jeff Bezos?
Well, I don't think it'll change it. I think we'll be as aggressive and as thoughtful as ever. I mean, it adds a new area for me to focus on, right? And so as his strategy becomes more apparent, it gives me a little bit more insight into the way the man works and what he's thinking.
And President Obama was slammed by many workers' rights organizations for giving a talk talking about Amazon creating middle-class jobs in these warehouses. Just quickly, have the conditions improved since that explosive report came out in the Seattle Times last year?
So the answer is, I think some. And, you know, I think Amazon has taken that issue seriously. The question is how much, and honestly, I don't know if I can answer that question. I don't know, but I certainly think they've taken that issue seriously.
All right. Well, we'll definitely have your colleague on again who wrote about that. So thank you so much. And John Nichols, final thoughts from you. What are you working on right now?
Tons of stuff, but
of course.
As always, I've been looking a lot. You opened up talking about the ALEC conference. I've been looking a lot at that. You know, this is an incredible story of an organization that operated behind the scenes, you know, for the better part of 40 years, exposed really by the incredible hard work of the Center for Media and Democracy, some other groups around this country. Bill Moyers doing a great documentary. And what we're showing is that independent media can really have an impact. It can cause, you know, bring things into the light. What we ought to be concerned about, is what I've been emphasizing again and again here, is making sure that as a people, as a country, we do the most we can to sustain and extend independent media and alternative media so that we get the coverage that we don't always get from our major media.
John Nichols is Washington correspondent for The Nation. Jay Green is a business reporter with the Seattle Times. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Terrific.
Thanks so much.
Thank you so much. And a quick mention, today is the last day our intern Laura Wenis will be with us. She's heading back to school in the East Coast. Laura, you have done an incredible job. She's even produced a few shows. Thank you so much. You'll be missed, and we hope you continue on your path in journalism. We need reporters like you. Thank you, Laura, and thanks for listening. What's the scope of government surveillance in the U.S.? On the next Jorah Call, we'll have a conversation about the National Security Agency and other agencies that gather and store troves of information on Americans. How do we make sense of the revelations that have surfaced? How have Edward Snowden's leaks changed the way we view the NSA? And will this lead to any changes? Join the conversation on the next Jorah Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Debbie Kennedy is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.